You've seen the headlines. Bonds are making a comeback. But if you've ever tried to invest in bonds, you know what a clunky, complicated, broken experience it can be. That's why at Public, they took fixed income and fixed it. Now you can find, evaluate, and buy thousands of bonds with an investing experience designed this century. Add fixed income to your portfolio with corporate, treasury, and municipal bonds. Go to public.com/bondspodcast to get started. This podcast is sponsored by Public. Full disclosures can be found at public.com/bonds. Chat with Traders is sponsored by Trade the Pool. Are concerns about limited buying power, insufficient capital, or fear of losing your own money preventing you from advancing your trading capabilities? Trade the Pool is an online stock trading prop firm that offers funding for stock traders. Demonstrate your skills, trade their capital, and keep your profits. You can engage in intraday trading and now swing trading on Trade the Pool with any U.S. stock or ETF. The procedure is straightforward. Pay an evaluation fee, successfully complete the evaluation, and get funded. Visit tradethepool.com/chat to learn more.
The biggest secret of the best traders in the world is that they're just like everyone else. However, they've worked hard to learn the markets and discover what works and what doesn't. But how can you hear about these journeys and get in on the strategies and tactics they use? You can do it by listening to Chat with Traders. Here's your host, Aaron Fifield.
What's happening, guys? I hope you had an awesome Christmas and you're enjoying a well-deserved break at this time of the year. Welcome to the podcast. You're listening to episode 53, and this week I interviewed an active Bitcoin trader who goes by the alias of BTC VIX, but for the purpose of this interview, we'll refer to him as VIX. It rolls off the tongue much easier. So as you can imagine, it's a little different. This is an area, or should I say a market, we haven't explored on the podcast in past interviews. But with that being said, I found this discussion to be really interesting, and I'm sure you will also. Some of the topics we spoke about include why VIX went from initially trading stocks and options over to Bitcoin markets, and we spend plenty of time discussing the landscape of Bitcoin. So going into how it's mined, how inflation is managed, the risks involved, and much more. Plus, another point VIX highlights towards the end is changing the way you may think about consistency and understanding nonlinear outcomes within your own trading results. But that's just a quick sample of topics ahead, so let's jump right to it. I'm your host, Aaron Fifield. This is the Chat with Traders podcast, and please welcome my guest to take us inside the world of cryptocurrencies, BTC VIX. Hey VIX, how's it going, buddy?
Good. Busy day in the crypto space.
Nice, good to hear. Well, we probably should explain the name situation. So I get that you want to keep the alias, which is totally fine. So I should just mention that you go by BTC VIX on Twitter, but most refer to you as VIX. Is this correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, awesome. Well, another thing I should probably point out is that I am very green when it comes to Bitcoin. So I don't know a great deal about the space, but I do find it super interesting. So throughout the discussion we're about to have here, we'll of course speak about your trading in detail. But I'm also keen to learn more about the landscape of Bitcoin. It's a side that I haven't really been exposed to, and I presume that's probably the case for many listening as well. Not all, because I know there are some listeners who tune in regularly who are Bitcoin traders, which is awesome. But yeah, I think it'll be a really interesting discussion. So thank you very much for coming on, and let's jump into it.
Alrighty.
So you weren't always a Bitcoin trader. So could you share with us how you very first got started trading? And let's go back one step further. What were you doing before this?
Before this, I came out of college after the financial crisis, kind of not knowing what I wanted to do. So I spent some time basically doing foreclosures and stuff. And I think that's what kind of initially got me interested in, hey, what's all going on behind this in the financial markets? So if you kind of progress from there, I think a lot of traders are they're trying to discover themselves in trading. So, you know, many of the guests that you've had on previously have kind of touched my life in some way. So starting with Tim Sykes and penny stock trading, and even through him, the bio run-up guys and biotech stocks that led me into the options space, and those guys over at S&B Capital. So it's taken quite a few turns to end up where I am today. But I think a lot of that, you know, is just a maturation process as a trader, trying to find your specific niche that kind of suits your personality with the trading style that, you know, is successful. So if, you know, we then I just was kind of curious in Bitcoin philosophically, you know, this uncontrolled nerd money that is able to be sent across the internet, doesn't know borders and stuff. So it got me interested initially just as kind of a curiosity from that standpoint. And for a long time, I never did trade Bitcoin. I was always kind of skeptical of the exchanges that Bitcoin trades on, that they would run off my money. And if some of the listeners might be familiar with, you know, a lot of exchanges have run off with people's money. So it wasn't really until after you had the run-up to 1200, it was November 2013, then we ended up losing the largest exchange at the time, Mt. Gox. Mt. Gox stood for Magic the Gathering Online Exchange. And, I mean, it's almost like a running joke that, you know, this exchange, which ended up at one time being the largest exchange for Bitcoin, you know, a $1 billion company at one point, started off as a, you know, a playing card exchange company. So by no means were they able to handle the kind of influx of users and the volume and the demand in that very short period of time. There's still a lot of controversy over what the fall of Gox was caused by, whether it was an inside job. Mark Capellas is a very kind of hated or, you know, infamous man in the Bitcoin space. So, you know, that's still to be determined as we sit here. But there's a lot of people currently out of money, out of Bitcoin. But it was that specific event that really got me trading Bitcoin, because I found an exchange called Bitfinex. And the interesting thing about Bitfinex is they actually allowed you to short Bitcoin. So some of my biggest profitable trades on Bitcoin in the early days was actually shorting it. And that's kind of what has sparked this whole finding of my niche into Bitcoin.
Okay, great. Yeah, that's a really interesting story. So let's unpack that a little further. I want to go back to when you very first started there. What type of success did you have with penny stocks, and what were you trading? Was it mostly the type of pump and dumps that, you know, most people trade when they go to penny stocks?
Yeah, I really tried to learn as much as I could from mostly Tim and his programs. I think one of the biggest things I ran into is trying to find borrows for those penny stocks to short. I was a losing trader at penny stocks. I think I blew up my account twice doing that. So clearly that wasn't my niche. And, you know, then it just kind of snowballed, and I just was a lost lamb, basically trying to find, you know, what it was that I could actually trade successfully. Because I wasn't doing very good up to then, but I had such a passion for the market, I didn't want to give it up.
Okay, yeah, and I mean, I think many can relate to that right there. I understand you also dabbled in options before switching to Bitcoin, and you may have even touched on this before, but I think you also touched biotech stocks. Can you tell us, like, what sort of success did you have with biotech stocks, and how were you approaching options as well?
The biotech trading phase that I went through, I think more than anything taught me what implied volatility means in an option and how that can really affect the price of it. And I think, you know, from there, even though I wasn't successful at trading biotechs either, I had some big wins, but I also had some massive losses because I was just basically a long premium options trader. I didn't understand spreads or anything like that, so it's very unsophisticated. And I think, you know, there's that progression of when you first get introduced to options, you're buying basically lottery tickets. And it's a strategy that gets you in the poorhouse very quickly. So after, you know, aimlessly wandering around through that, I came upon spread, you know, options spread trading. SMB and those guys at the Options Tribe did a great job of showing me successful strategies, and I still do trade some of those strategies today with my Thinkorswim account. It's still just more of a passive account because I focus mainly on Bitcoin.
Okay, so I mean, it sounds as though you really did try a whole range of trading styles and even markets. When did your results begin to change from sort of being an average trader or a lost lamb, like you called it earlier, to becoming profitable? When did that start to turn around for you?
Yeah, even beginning in Bitcoin, my P&L was swinging around very wildly. And it took some time to get a grasp of the Bitcoin market, but I feel like it's a much more you know, fluid market. It doesn't have opens and closes. You know, it's a 24/7 market, so it just seemed to suit my personality more. And I was able then, after blowing out my account several times, learning the hard way that risk management is number one. So that's really what, you know, ended up being making me profitable is, you know, just managing risk. And it sounds so easy, but as you know, it becomes a very slippery slope with that kind of gambling mentality a lot of traders get into.
Okay. So you've mentioned a couple times now that you've blown up multiple accounts, you know, in the earlier years. If you had to summarize that for us, why were you blowing up these accounts? What mistakes were you making over and over again that was causing this?
Mostly it was just too large of positions for my account size. And then you couple that with once you have a number of losing trades, you get into that revenge trading. And I think those two things were the most toxic to my trading profession in those early days. Is I would get on a losing streak, my position size would keep increasing, the losses would add up, and eventually my account would be gone, and I have to take a break. And I'd always come back saying, "Hey, you know, you need to manage risk," and then there'd be one big loss that would put me on tilt again. So that's really been a big learning curve for me in both trading and just life in general, is to kind of understand when emotions are affecting my trading. Not to take emotion out of trading, because we aren't robots, that'll always be a part of it. But when you recognize that emotions affecting trading, you have to have some defense mechanism.
Yeah, I think that's a really great point you highlighted there, actually, is just having a great level of self-awareness can be a huge benefit in knowing where you're going wrong. So yeah, great point you highlighted. So tell us, what was your first encounter with Bitcoin? Like, how did you first get going in Bitcoin? Did you take, tell us about maybe your first trade, if you remember that.
So I did... early 2013, Bitcoin was at about $30, and I took some money I had laying around and just bought Bitcoin. I put Bitcoin in the corner and kind of didn't really think about it. Bitcoin then went from $30 to $266, crashed back down, wandered around 100 for 6 months, and then we had the bubble to 1200. So all during that period of time, I wasn't trading Bitcoin at all. But the real first trade that I had was when we started to see the real problems come out of Mt. Gox. And I felt like I had a real opportunity there to short Bitcoin. The exchange had been having withdrawal problems for the better part of 6 months. And they had just at the time, it was like late January, early February, they had then stopped Bitcoin withdrawals as well. They had had their fiat withdrawals suspended for 6 months. So the writing was on the wall that there was going to be volatility coming into the market, and it wasn't going to be net positive for Bitcoin. So that's really when I started looking at where can I short Bitcoin, and I came across this exchange called Bitfinex, and I placed my first trade. And I remember the next day, Mark Capellas came out and with a letter saying that the exchange problems were due to this bug of Bitcoin. And it wasn't a bug in Bitcoin. It was just basically he did a shitty job of implementing it into his exchange.
Right. Okay. That's really interesting. So, I mean, from the little bit I know about Bitcoin, I sense there are many Bitcoin enthusiasts doing this, like operating with Bitcoin, whether they're trading or just buying into it. They're doing this for political reasons. Was this the case for you in any way?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly came out of that kind of libertarian gold bug camp at one point in time. That the idea that gold is money, and I kind of look back at it now and realize how bad gold is as money in the digital age. And I think that was really the missing piece of once I found Bitcoin, I was like, wow, like this is kind of what many libertarians and sound money advocates have been looking for. So that was really what captivated me in those early days of when I found Bitcoin. And I just dove into it. I wanted to know everything about Bitcoin.
Right. Okay. So before I ask you about how you trade, I should probably ask, what is Bitcoin and what's so significant about Bitcoin? I think it's probably good that we bring this up because we have to think there's quite possibly people listening who might be hearing about Bitcoin for the first time right now. So just give us the 30-second summary, if possible, to explain what is Bitcoin.
Sure. The 2 second version is digital cash. But if we extend that out, we're really looking at there's a ledger that basically lives across many different computers, and it's just a software program. And, you know, that's how basically value is transferred. It's just an entry on the ledger, and it's software that we've all agreed upon. So that's really kind of it in a nutshell. And that's how the value is passed, is this ledger is not controlled by any central party. It can't be shut down by going to the office of Bitcoin Inc. There is no Bitcoin company or Bitcoin CEO.
Sure, that's a great explanation, actually, and we'll go into this much more as we go. But for now, let me ask you, how do you trade? Like, what's the best way to describe your trading approach?
Sure. I would start out with basically when I look at the Bitcoin chart, kind of at a basic level, we hear people talk about horizontal support and resistance. And I would actually take that a little bit further and call it kind of like order block theory. And you're basically looking at, where clusters of orders are going to be, and the market makers or the larger players are going to push into those areas. So that's kind of what I look at as a roadmap with Bitcoin. Now, that when price is basically channeling, I'm looking at the Bollinger Bands, am looking for breakout conditions. So that would be range expansion. And, you know, I'm going to try and go with the trend and have a take profit into those order block areas. And then on the other side of things is Bitcoin, when it trends, it tends to trend very hard. And then it'll have a period where it consolidates or range contraction. So at that period, you know, I'll go into more of a scalp mode. And that's kind of really my basic strategy of Bitcoin.
Okay, so the block areas, like how do you identify these? Like how do you see a block area on a chart? Is it where price is consolidating and it's hitting horizontal support and resistance, or is there something more to it?
It's kind of hard to describe it without a visual, but you know, you're looking basically kind of like where a wick of a candle is, and then a body of a the next candle or the prior candle, and you're going to be able to draw a rectangle, a horizontal rectangle across the chart. And it's really amazing how often Bitcoin will hit those targets. It's kind of similar to Forex. Forex does that a lot, you know, being a 24/5 market. There's a lot of order block theory with Forex as well. And I think Bitcoin trades very similarly in that way.
Okay, so what's your average holding time? You said there that in certain situations you sort of go into a scalp mode. What's your average holding time when you're, you know, scalping Bitcoin and when the conditions are more normalized?
My hold time is actually pretty low. I would say between 4 and 8 hours. However, the interesting thing about Bitcoin is you can take a long position or take a position that's in the direction of the trend and then basically scalp the counter trend or those periods of consolidation if you think the trend is going to continue. So I do that as well. But I'm actually a pretty short-term trader, mainly because I like to actually go to sleep. You know, Bitcoin doesn't sleep, but I like to sleep. So I usually try and flatten out. And, you know, 4 to 8 hours is pretty average.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. So essentially, it's safe to say that a lot of the sort of the basic technical analysis theory that we're taught as traders is just as relevant to Bitcoin markets as it is to stocks and futures and Forex and, you know, across those markets?
Yeah, I think it's almost more applicable to Bitcoin. And I know you've had, you know, Sang Lucci and Haim on, and they talk a lot about how basically all of retail strategies have been you know, put in an algorithm and are there to defeat retail traders and take their money. Now, Bitcoin, still in its virgin state, and the markets don't have those kind of algorithmic and HFT players, I think the technical analysis of Bitcoin is a little bit more pure in the sense of those indicators that we learn at the early stages.
Right, okay. Yeah, that's really interesting, Vix. If you had to break it down for us, what would you say are some of the important trader characteristics you have learned and adapted over the years that have helped your trading?
All right. Well, I think it may sound kind of funny, but I like the idea of having trader amnesia. So, you know, waking up the next day and really having no idea what the last day brought, whether it was good or bad, because I think either way, if you're bringing the prior day's trading emotions, whether it was a high or low, into your current state, there's potential there to basically be disrupting or influencing, and ultimately it's going to lead you astray of your plan.
Okay, I like that. So essentially that helps you to show up every day without having any bias about how you'll trade, you know, over the next few hours.
Yeah, and I think, you know, kind of on that same line of thought, it's I take kind of a contention with when somebody says they want to be consistently profitable in trading. And I guess I should clarify. It's kind of when I hear somebody say that they want to make, you know, $300 a day and they can quit their day job. I think weekly goals are good, but if you get really caught up in that P&L paralysis where you're trying to hit a certain dollar amount each day, you're going to stop listening to the markets and your TA and, you know, all of those order block theories and stuff. That's really your trade plan. And you're going to start staring at your P&L because you're at 280 for the day and you want 300 as your goal, but the market might not be giving you any more. So I think that's one thing that I wish consistently profitable is kind of not talked about as much.
Yeah, again, that's a really valid point. I mean, it's about not trying to sort of push your beliefs onto the market and just kind of trading what's in front of you, I guess. Now, we don't normally talk about sort of current market events, like what's going on in the market right now, normally on the podcast, but I do know that Bitcoin has been putting in some big moves recently. You know, not that I follow it too closely, but I am aware that it has been putting in some big moves. What's been driving this? Are there any underlying technical or fundamental factors behind it?
Sure. So I want to be very careful with kind of applying any narrative fallacy to Bitcoin because, personally, I find that a lot of times price action happens and then, you know, people apply some story to it being the reason. So fundamentally, though, I think at kind of the global macro way, it is that we're seeing that China's devaluing its currency, the yuan, and China has very strict capital controls of the mainlanders getting their cash out of China. So with those kind of that perfect storm going on there, I think Bitcoin is being used as a vehicle to get capital of China. It's not the only way. It might not even be the best way, but it is a way. And I think we're seeing some bleed over from that. And then technically, coming back to the Bollinger Bands, we've had a weekly Bollinger Band breakout. We spent all of 2014 basically going down. We spent the last 10 months of 2015 going range bound sideways between $200 and $300, and just in the last month and a half, we've broken out of that 300 range and currently sit at 450 today.
Okay, so just while we're on the topic, are there any sort of, how do I say this? Are there any types of news events that come out around Bitcoin that have an impact on the price? Like if we bring that back to stocks, you've got, your company news, your earnings reports. Is there anything similar that affects the price or has an impact on the price in the Bitcoin markets?
Bitcoin is interesting in that sense. I know the first time that it was announced that the U.S. Marshals were going to auction off, at the time it was the largest dark market, and they seized the Bitcoins from it, and they said, we're going to auction these coins off. The Bitcoin reacted very violently. I think it went down like $50 to $100 in that day. So, that seemed to affect it, but we've had three other Marshall auctions since then, which doesn't seem to have as much effect when they announce it because it's kind of priced in. We also have kind of when merchants, very large retailers accept Bitcoin, that's initially used to spike Bitcoin, but the one thing is the merchant is going to ultimately take their Bitcoins and convert it into fiat. So that's net selling pressure on the Bitcoin price. So it's kind of like a very murky way of looking at things if you're trying to play Bitcoin news. I've felt, at least my trading style, I try and tune most of that out.
Okay. And sorry, I forgot what you called it there at the beginning, the Marshall auctions. What's that about?
Yeah, I should probably, let's take one step back and just quickly talk about that. There was a drug and dark marketplace bazaar known as the Silk Road. You could buy, it was mainly for drugs, but, illegal IDs and such. And one of the very early uses of Bitcoin was basically to use that as payment to buy, this merchandise off of this website that lives under Tor. That's a hole where all the dark markets live. And anyways, the U.S. authorities were after, the operators of this bazaar for quite some time. And eventually, there's a whole huge story that you can read that's almost beyond like what, a prize-winning writer could come up with as far as the plot line and the twist goes. But they seized... I think it was 120,000 Bitcoin, which is pretty significant. So after seizing them, anytime a government agency seizes property, they end up selling it off and taking the proceeds from it.
Okay. And yeah, there's a really cool documentary about the whole Silk Road situation. Just on a side note there, I know it's totally off topic from trading, but Deep Web, very cool documentary. Have you seen that one?
I have not seen that one yet. Okay. Still on my to-watch list.
It's really cool. It's made by the guy, I'm forgetting his name, it's totally slipped my mind,
Ted, right?
No, it's made by the guy who made the documentary about Napster as well, called Download.
Okay.
Yeah, so check that documentary out. Really interesting. All right, so where were we? So Bitcoin is obviously the largest, most common cryptocurrency that does exist, but there are many others as well. Do you trade other cryptocurrencies as well?
I usually don't. I guess that kind of puts me in the Bitcoin purist camp, mainly because I tend to find that my niche is Bitcoin, so I rarely go into what we call the altcoins. And there's actually thousands of these, probably the most famous being Litecoin, which is kind of Bitcoin's little brother. And Litecoin is actually traded on many of the major exchanges as well. But me personally, I tend to shy away from trading those coins. Some of them, you have a couple individuals that literally hold, 90% of those coins. So it's not something that I really see I have an edge in. So I just shy away from it.
Right. Okay. So why do these other cryptocurrencies exist? Like, what purpose do they serve?
Sure. So basically the nice thing about Bitcoin being a completely open source project is anybody can fork the code, take the code, make some minor tweaks, and release their own coin of whatever it is. So some of it, just to compare Bitcoin to Litecoin, is one of the major differences is block time. So Bitcoin has it at 10 minutes, Litecoin has it at 2 minutes. It just basically means your transaction gets picked up by the miners faster and is on that ledger that we talked about at a faster pace. So that's one area that's kind of differentiates some of the altcoins. Just trying to think of some of the ones that have gotten popular. One of them is more of an anonymous coin that mixes the transactions, so you can't really tell what's on the blockchain. it's everybody trying to kind of get the right tweak of Bitcoin that Bitcoin never had, basically.
Okay, and do these serve any purpose outside of, I don't know, holding a digital currency? Like, I know with Bitcoin, there are places around that accept it as a form of currency. You can actually purchase goods and services with it. What purpose do these smaller cryptocurrencies serve?
Well, I might offend some of the altcoiners that are listening, but I see it just mostly as a speculative vehicle in entirety. I've looked at some of the altcoins, and I still don't really see a bright future for those as far as mainstream use. That's not to say that there can't be one, but I don't have as much interest in those altcoins.
Okay. Yeah, fair enough. And a word you used in your last response there, which I wanted to ask you about, block time. What does the word block refer to? I mean, this is often associated with Bitcoin. What does it actually refer to when you say block?
So basically, I think it's kind of, they came up with the term mining Bitcoin, which I think everybody in their mind comes up with the idea that, you know, you're going into this dark hole and you're trying to extract Bitcoin. And to kind of a simplified version, that is what's going on. But the miners are basically providing the hash power that's securing the network of Bitcoin. And they're taking all these incoming transactions and they're bundling them up. And in order to incentivize these miners to give hash power to the Bitcoin network, because, you know, there's a ton of electricity cost there, hardware cost. Basically, if they solve this arbitrary math problem fast enough, they get what's known as the block reward, which is basically like money creation. So it's, that is why the miners do what they do. And then once they get it all bundled and they solve this math problem, that's what's known as a block. And with Bitcoin, there's some really deep math with it, but basically the difficulty can adjust to that we know roughly that it takes 10 minutes for each one of these hard math problems to be solved by these miners. And it adjusts. If the hashing power goes up, the math problem becomes harder to solve. So that's what's kind of keeping basically that inflation in check.
Okay, so so this gets complicated really quick.
So it does.
How does the who's create? Oh, this is probably a really dumb question, but who is creating the math problem? Like, where does that come from?
So, you know, we all agreed to basically use the software. And the software has rules in it, right? And the rules, you know, state these kind of math problems that are going on. And it was all basically in the code originally when it was created by Satoshi Nakamoto, this, you know, figure that we don't know who it is. Which is a whole nother story, but it's just ultimately in the code that is what's determining those math problems, and it knows the hashing power and it adjusts accordingly for the difficulty.
Right. Okay. So it's forever evolving. Like, just because you crack it once to, you know, create one Bitcoin or one block, like it then changes again for the next Bitcoin or block that you want to create. Am I following that correctly?
Yeah, you're on the right line. And every time a block is solved, all the miners, you know, basically it's a really hard problem to crack, but it's really easy to verify. So once the miner has solved it, it propagates this, you know, global network, and the nodes that are running basically say this is properly solved. All the miners move on to the next block, which just means the transactions that are coming in, they're bundling them up and they're trying to solve the next hardest problem.
Okay. I think I'm following along. So how many Bitcoins, like can these, the guys who are mining Bitcoins, can they just keep going forever, or is there going to reach a limit where there can only be so many Bitcoins mined? Like, is there only ever going to be a certain amount in circulation, or will it forever increase?
So it's, what do they call it? Like an asymptotic curve, where basically 21 million is the hard limit of Bitcoin, but I think it's every 4 years, the amount of block reward gets cut in half. So if you think about it, if we started at 50 was the original, 25, 12 and a half, 6.25, you know, and so on, eventually it gets down to where the block reward is just ever smaller as we keep going on. But they can still collect the transaction fees off the network, which is part of the incentive. But the inflation, as far as kind of like the limited resource aspect of it, does have that 21 million hard-coded limit.
Okay. 21 million, right.
You've seen the headlines. Bonds are making a comeback. But if you've ever tried to invest in bonds, you know what a clunky, complicated, broken experience it can be. That's why at Public, they took fixed income and fixed it. Now you can find, evaluate, and buy thousands of bonds with an investing experience designed this century. They started at the beginning, reimagining the bond screener with an intuitive design that helps you zero in on the exact kinds of bonds you're looking for. Then they made it easier to evaluate each investment opportunity with better data in the places you need it most. Finally, they made investing in bonds as straightforward as stocks or any other asset. Add fixed income to your portfolio with corporate, treasury, and municipal bonds. Go to public.com/bondspodcast to get started. This podcast is sponsored by Public. Full disclosures can be found at public.com/bonds.
Are you a developing or seasoned day trader who trades the U.S. markets? Is the only thing stopping you from getting to the next level is having enough capital to trade? Trade the Pool is a unique online stock trading prop firm that funds stock traders worldwide. Not having to risk your own capital can help you focus on other things like making better decisions on your trades. There's no PDT rules to worry about. You got more than 12,000 stocks and ETFs to trade, long or short, and professional tools at your side. How you get funded is you show them your skills through a straightforward evaluation process. Once you pass the evaluation, you get funded and trade with their pool of money and split the profits. Don't let the lack of buying power, capital, or fear of losing your own money prevent you from taking your trading to the next level. Visit tradethepool.com/chat to learn more.
So you touched on the creator of Bitcoin there, which you said is a whole nother story. What do you think was his motive for creating, or her? I mean, we don't know who it is. What do you think was their motive for creating Bitcoin?
I have to say, I'm definitely not an expert at kind of his writings. I know many people have tried to kind of analyze what he had written on Bitcoin Talk in the early days when he was corresponding with Gavin Andreessen and some of the people that are actually known in the community. And it seems to be that he was somewhat politically motivated, kind of coming out of the financial crisis of 2008. That's one narrative that I've heard, and it seems somewhat plausible. Also, the fact that the internet, you know, it doesn't really have a native payment gateway. I mean, we use credit cards in kind of this makeshift manner, but Bitcoin kind of is the internet cash, which we haven't had up till Bitcoin.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah, I mean, it's quite a mysterious world, isn't it? I find it really fascinating. Let's bring this back to trading a little bit. Why would someone want to trade Bitcoin over the listed markets? And also, what are the barriers to entry like?
You know, one of the biggest advantages or curses is that it's the only true 24/7 market that is out there. There is no downtime other than the exchanges that you might be on going down for some reason. So that's one thing that I can see as an advantage. Maybe some people want to trade on the weekends, and you know they work 9 to 5 Monday through Friday, so that could be early entry for them into trading. Secondly, is as far as barriers to entry, once you have Bitcoin, Bitcoin doesn't really know how old you are. You know, it doesn't require documentation or anything like that. So you can send it across the world and fund your trading accounts. And that's from email sign up to sending your Bitcoin to an exchange like Bitfinex is going to take you one block confirmation, so 10 minutes. And you're up and trading with whatever amount that you want to trade. That's a huge advantage, if you ask me.
Okay, so you wouldn't come across the problem of the pattern day trader rule. I know that's an issue for many traders sort of starting out in the States there. Is you obviously get around that problem as there's no account minimum to start with?
Yeah, there's literally, I think the smallest is like 0.01 is like what you can... is the smallest trade amount, which I think is $4 now. So anything from there up is the limit. So there is no account minimum. There is no restrictions as far as you can't do 3 day trades. You can go through as many trades as you want. There's none of those kind of things that go on in Bitcoin.
Okay, cool. And we may have already touched on this just a little bit. I'd like to dig a little bit deeper. Who are the market participants in Bitcoin? Like, who are you up against? Who are you competing against? Obviously, you take this very seriously. But do you find there are also like many participants who are just there to sort of punt and try their luck? And yeah, who's on the other sides of your trades?
I think the interesting thing about what the Bitcoin market is currently is we have kind of the natural market participants, which I would consider the miners. The miners need to exchange some of their Bitcoin to pay, you know, electricity, server cost, hardware upgrades, as well as the merchant processors that are, when you send your Bitcoin to Expedia, they're using a merchant processor like BitPay, and BitPay is giving Expedia US dollars. So they have to source that liquidity somewhere, and they're doing it off of exchanges. So there's some kind of natural, I'm using air quotes, users of the exchange in that way. And then there's like a huge gap where we don't really see a lot of like institutional activity in Bitcoin, whether it be just kind of like your buy side, you know, taking large positions or hedge funds. We basically then have a very heavy active retail segment, which is very on lines with kind of like a degenerate gambler mentality.
Okay. So in that case, I mean, I'm not sure what sort of volume is transacted on a typical day, but how easy is it for a participant with a lot of Bitcoin to push around the price and essentially manipulate the market? Is that a risk?
It certainly is, and Bitcoin is definitely driven by, kind of whale wars of sorts at times that move price on different exchanges. Sometimes one exchange is leading, and then other time it's following. So these participants aren't, confined to one specific exchange. And depending if you're on that exchange, it can be advantageous or a disadvantage too. Sometimes a big move will happen on a different exchange and your exchange hasn't moved yet. So there's a opportunity for you to take advantage of that before the price, comes more in line with with what we'd see at kind of an equilibrium.
Okay. So in that case, how many exchanges are there for Bitcoin?
I think there's probably 6 to 8 main exchanges. And for me, I primarily watch 4 exchanges that I consider really the leading exchanges in Bitcoin. And interestingly enough, none of them are in the US.
Really? Is that just the 4 that you watch, or none of them are in the US?
Well, none of the exchanges in the US, I feel, are very leading as far as an exchange goes. So I don't watch them very actively. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, so there are exchanges that do exist in the States, but you don't watch those ones. I probably should have said that. That's a more clear way of saying
it. Okay. That's, yes.
Cool. All right, so while we're on the topic of risks, or getting into it, what risks are you exposed to when dealing with Bitcoin? Like, we've spoken in the past a few times, and one of the things you mentioned to me was counterparty risk is very real. What do you mean by this? And are there any other additional risks that exist when dealing with Bitcoin?
So with Bitcoin, it has this history, as I was alluding to earlier, with Mt. Gox probably being the most famous example of the exchange going bust and the traders or account holders losing basically 100% of their principal. We don't know if through all the legal stuff if they're going to get any of that back. So, you know, many of these people have been sitting for a couple of years now with no reimbursement. And, you know, that exchange wasn't built to handle the load that we see on Bitcoin. So you have a lot of, like, early tech geeks that built an exchange, and, you know, problems arise that they didn't see as far as scalability goes. Then, you know, your funds are at risk on these exchanges, which is, there's no insurance, right? There's, if you open a brokerage account in the U.S., you have FDIC insurance. So even if your brokerage goes bust, you know, they'll still reimburse you your principal amount. Now, that doesn't happen in Bitcoin. In Bitcoin, it's very, you know, caveat emptor as far as that goes. So it, you know, some people manage that risk differently. And as far as other risks with Bitcoin, there is no Bitcoin hotline to call or customer service line if you send your Bitcoins to the wrong address. I've been guilty of this. Luckily, it wasn't too much, but I copy and pasted an address that I no longer had control of, and I sent the coins there, and then I realized, wow, that's an address I don't have the keys for anymore. So, you know, that's a risk too. And I think that's kind of what scares some of the people with Bitcoin that aren't technical savvy. You know, some of those mistakes can be pretty scary.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm sure the person on the receiving end got a nice surprise when they saw some of your Bitcoins come through. What about the threat of hackers? I mean, do hackers oppose any threat to Bitcoin? You mentioned, like, there's quite a lot of, or can be, risk associated with exchanges. What about when you're just holding the Bitcoins in your Bitcoin wallet or your account?
Yeah, there's been plenty of Reddit posts about people getting their Bitcoin accounts hacked. It tends to be they have a hot wallet, which just means it's sitting on their computer that's plugged into the internet. They get a Trojan or something like that. Somebody sweeps the keys, and once they have the keys, if your wallet's not password protected or it's got a weak password, you know, they now have control of your Bitcoins. And as well as the exchanges, they get hacked too. So that comes back to this idea of counterparty risk. So even they who have gone great lengths to protect their assets do on occasion get hacked. We haven't had a major one since Mt. Gox. I mean, I'm knocking on wood now, but it does happen.
Okay. And what about you? Do you keep all your profits in Bitcoin or do you transfer them out into US dollars from time to time?
It depends. I like to keep most of my profits in Bitcoin just because I think in the Bitcoin, you know, mindset. So I'm always thinking of, am I up or down X amount of Bitcoins? I don't often try and translate it in my head to US dollars. But, you know, on occasion, I'll make purchases with Bitcoin, take a trip or something like that.
Okay. So, I mean, let's start to wind this down. I've just got a few more questions here. Thinking big picture, like long term, where do you see Bitcoin headed in the future? Is it going to take over and make a huge difference in the world? What are your thoughts on this?
Well, one of the things that's being talked about a lot is you have the very large, well-known banks, you know, Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, Citigroup. They're trying to somehow incorporate blockchain technology into their business model, because I think they've recognized that that creation is extremely valuable. Now, they tend to kind of throw away the idea of Bitcoin, but they focus on this blockchain technology. So I do think blockchain technology is not going away. Now, does that mean Bitcoin itself is going to be the ultimate success? That's still to be determined. I have hope for it. I think it has the largest network effect right now. Doesn't mean that can't change, but I tend to think that that'll just continue to grow as we see more of these large companies try and plug into it. It'll just keep growing, that network effect.
Sure. Okay. Yeah. I mean, there's definitely an interesting road ahead, and it's awesome to get your take on that. Now, you're part of a very active community/resource for Bitcoin traders called Whale Club. What's this all about, and how'd you get it started?
Sure. So basically, if we rewind back to kind of my early start in trading Bitcoin during Mount Gox, the fall of Mount Gox, many of us ended up on this platform called TradingView. And TradingView is a charting platform, and they were one of, not the only one, but one of the first charting platforms to have Bitcoin charts on it. So naturally, Bitcoiners that are trading Bitcoin ended up there, and they have a chat feature. So many of us kind of got to know each other, but ultimately, the markets would move, and you know, you're sitting in, like a lot of day traders, in complete silence, alone. So we jumped on a Google Hangout one day, and it kind of, snowballed from there. As we max out the Google Hangout of 10 people, we would go with live Google Hangouts, but there's a restriction of 8 hours, and many people would be logging in to hear what's going on with price action. So then we made the transition to a TeamSpeak server. We currently have 1,000 slots open. I think right now we have about 150 to 200 people on there. And really, it's just kind of an open squawk box of, you know, the Bitcoin price action that's going on. And it also provides a really interesting resource for the traders, because many of the exchange operators have ended up coming onto our platform, and you know, they're just part members of the community just the same, but you know, they kind of duel as customer service reps too. And it's very important when things do happen to the exchange, downtime for whatever reason, that they're immediately on there saying, hey, this is what's going on with our exchange, this is why we're down. And we get that information faster than anybody else. I see, you know, Twitter posts or Reddit, but I'm talking to the exchange operator, you know, right as it happens.
Yeah, that's really cool, and it's awesome that you've been able to put that together. And you know, you've got a really decent sized community in there. I think that's an awesome resource. All right, Vex. Well, let's do one last question. I mean, I haven't asked this one in a long time, but I think you're going to give a really great answer. What's one book that's been really helpful to you that you'd like to recommend to other traders?
It's an interesting one, and I have to confess that I'm kind of a diehard Nassim Taleb fan. So he's famous for writing The Black Swan and more recently Anti-Fragile. But one of the concepts that come out of that book are kind of the differences of linearity versus non-linearity. And I think that's very important for a trader because our profession is about the nonlinear. Just as I referenced back to kind of that myopia mindset of I need to make X amount of dollars per day. You know, you might have 5 weeks that you lose or make next to nothing. Hopefully you're at least a little bit ahead. And then 1 week that really defines, you know, a quarter, half a year, or even your whole year. So that's kind of the non-linear versus non-linearity. You know, Taleb himself is a former options trader. So I think that's what it did for me was kind of break my mindset of stopping to think in such linear terms.
Right. I like that. And that's actually one book I'm keen to check out. Jack Little, who was on a few weeks back, he also mentioned both those titles. Yeah, I mean, really keen to check that out. There's just so many books I want to read, just not a fast enough reader to get through them all.
Yeah, there are a ton.
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, thank you very much for doing this, Vex. Where can listeners go to find out more about you? So maybe your website for Whale Club and also your Twitter handle.
Yeah, just at BTC Vex. Is my Twitter handle. We're working on the website, but currently we have quite a bit up on whaleclub.org. We have if you follow me on Twitter, there's a Telegram group. Currently we have about 600 people in there. And then from there, if you want to come on TeamSpeak, you can do that as well. We find a lot of people like the Telegram group for just kind of, they're always plugged in on mobile because TeamSpeak's it's kind of an old, you know, Counter-Strike era program.
Okay, so what's Telegram? That's just a platform, like a chat platform, is it?
Yeah, it's kind of like WhatsApp, if you're familiar with that.
Okay, yep. I don't use it, but I'm familiar with how it works, yeah. Okay, cool. All right, well, I'll make sure to include all those links in the show notes at Chat With Traders. So, you know, if you do forget those, they'll be all there in one place at chatwithtraders.com. Vex, thanks so much for doing this. You've exposed me and probably a whole lot of listeners to a side that we really knew very little about. So I really appreciate you taking the time to do this.
Thanks for having me on, Aaron.
No trouble. We'll speak to you soon.
You've come to the end of this episode of Chat with Traders, but don't worry, more great episodes are on the way. To stay updated with each great new episode, be sure to subscribe to the podcast in iTunes, and we'd love it if you leave us a rating and review. We'll see you next time on Chat with Traders.